Let's be real. Eating healthy can be a hassle. Stressing about nutrition, planning meals, shopping for ingredients. What if there was an easier way? Meet Sunbasket, a team of dietitians and chefs that design wholesome, nutritious, and delicious meal kits delivered to your door. Each week, you can choose from a brand new selection of quick and easy meal kit recipes with a wide variety of dietary options, plus dozens of snacks, salads, breakfast items, and more. You can pick and choose from recipe options like vegetarian, Mediterranean, carb conscious, the list goes on. My family tested out the sirloin steak and the salmon last week, and it was a big winner at the dinner table. All of Sunbasket's meal kits are quick and easy, even if you're not a pro in the kitchen. Thanks to Sunbasket's commitment to clean ingredients and organic fresh produce, there's no easier way to eat your very best. Go to sunbasket.com/mindful today to save $120 across your first four deliveries. That's sunbasket.com/mindful to save $120 across your first four deliveries, plus free shipping on your first order. If people are dieting now more than ever, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs, or medium-chain triglycerides, are unique compounds that can be easily converted into ketones and provide an efficient fuel source for your body, thereby enhancing your energy production potential. Instead of turning into fat when you consume them, MCTs turn into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. MCT Wellness is Dr. Gundry's polyphenol-rich MCT powder aimed at boosting your body's fat-burning capacity. What's amazing is this energy boost can be felt quickly. It doesn't take months or years to make a difference. It's also very easy to add to your routine. There are 3 great flavors to choose from, and you just add a scoop of MCT Wellness to some water or your favorite drink and enjoy. So if you want to experience a quick and effective boost to your metabolic potential, go to GundryMD.com/mindful and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular priced order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/mindful. Robert Breedlove, thank you for joining me on the Mindful Movement podcast, man.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
I'm really excited to talk to you and meet you, or fake meet you, internet meet you. You know, I'm always like going through a rotation of podcasts in my spare time, and maybe every 6 or 8 months, one will fall out of the rotation and one comes in. And the What Is Money podcast has been in the regular rotation for quite some time now. So I appreciate all you're doing and all the work I know you put into it to put forth some pretty useful content.
Oh, thank you. I'm honored to be in your rotation.
Talking about Bitcoin is definitely not as typical as the topics we have on this podcast, but ultimately, I try to empower folks to play a bigger role in their sense of well-being. And as I've gotten older and been able to reflect more and like observe my relationship with money and finances in general, I realize that it really does have a big impact of our sense of well-being, the relationship we have with whatever we consider is, you know, money or finances or, and, you know, and when you don't have a clear idea of what that means to you, it could, it might not support your well-being very well. You know, it could have some real costs. And I guess I've been interested in finances for a while. When I was in college, I went and I wanted to be like a stockbroker, and I studied quantitative finance for about 5 minutes, and then I wind up for various reasons switching to economics, and I had this really classical economics trained professor that had an influence on me, and I've been ruined ever since. I mean, every time I would see a chart with, let's say, a supply and demand where there's quantity on one axis and price on the other, I just felt like, well, this graph doesn't mean anything because the money axis isn't real. It's that there's inherently not a free market in the cost of money because humans have kind of botched that one. So this whole thing is nonsense. And it made me question things and, push back a lot. And then eventually when I was introduced to Bitcoin, it resonated with me as like, oh, this is an answer in so many different ways. Yet when I talk to what I would consider educated people and ask them about it, I get the blank stare, like, or they're looking at me like I'm crazy for considering it has any value. And I don't know how much our audience knows about this, but it's a topic that's interesting to me. And I feel like it does play a big role in our relationship with ourselves and how we navigate the world. And I was hoping you would come on and maybe give a little Bitcoin 101, why it exists, its importance in the long term, and maybe a little bit about what brought you to care on your end also.
Sure. Don't know where to start. I guess I could start with why do I care? So for me, I don't know where to mark the beginning of my journey, but I grew up as a very curious kid, and my mom, I think, just got tired of answering all my questions, so she really started to push me to read a lot at a young age. And I eventually got into video games. By the time I was 11 years old, I was playing this massive online multiplayer game called Diablo 2. And this is a PC game, kind of like a Dungeons and Dragons, but, you know, hundreds of thousands of people playing online around the world. And inside of this game, you could accumulate items, you know, armor, weapons, etc., accessories. And then you could play the game, you know, you could go and fight the demons and the zombies and all that, or you could exit the game and actually go into these basically trade channels, which were like, you know, stock exchanges, but not for stocks, for the actual items. You know, you could trade swords and shields and all the things. And so I started out playing the game, the actual monster slaying game, but over time I started to becoming more focused on the trading game, like just learning how to profit, basically buy low, sell high, advertise well, haggle, negotiate. And so I ended up just accumulating a lot of wealth in that game. And then eventually this is when eBay was becoming popular, people started spending what I thought was real money, US dollars, to buy these items in the game, or even accounts that had a whole bunch of items. And so that really left a mark on me. And the impression was that, you know, somehow this imaginary video game world that I had become wealthy in was somehow permeating the real world. And so my intuition was like, this is going to change everything, right? Everything, all human interactions will be video game like at some point. And so it was kind of like a premonition about the onset of the digital age, I guess. You know, obviously this is early days of the internet. This is like, I guess, 2000 probably, so like pretty early days. So there was that got me into kind of the vein of where technology meets money, meets commerce, meets digital tech. And then fast forward to 2005, I think. I read the book. I was very curious about economics and money. I didn't understand how the stock market worked, actually. It was just a total mystery to me. And I was, you know, I guess I just graduated high school, going to college, not, you know, trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And in trying to figure that out, I wanted to understand what a stock market is, how markets work, et cetera. And so I was reading different things. I was reading like The Economist magazine. I was reading some economics newsletters. One of the economics newsletters I read suggested the book The Creature from Jekyll Island by G. Edward Griffin. And when I read that book, that was my real black pill moment for central banking, that for the first time adequately explained kind of the nature of money, the history of money, what a central bank is, tells the whole origin story of the Federal Reserve, which is the central bank of the United States. And it's a wonderful book. It's, you know, obviously nonfiction, but it's written like a detective novel. So it's very, very engaging, very captivating. And, you know, I don't want to ruin it for anyone, but basically the punchline is central banking is the largest criminal organization in the history of the human race, basically, in terms of, you know, purchasing power stolen, which you could say is equivalent to human time and energy, right? The time, human time and energy that goes into producing all the goods that the central bank steals through the counterfeiting of currency, basically. And then to compound that, that counterfeited currency is often used to fund warfare, to fund fake news, to fund propaganda, to fund limitless centralization and government overgrowth. So at that point, I felt like I had really stumbled upon like the main problem in the world. And it's that we have an organized crime syndicate that basically runs the show. And however, there was nothing to do about it at the time. It was just like this kind of dim realization, grim rather than dim, pretty bright, but grim. And I didn't know what to do about it necessarily. So I just sort of went on with my life, you know, went to school. I ended up studying accounting and finance, got my master's degree in accounting, ended up becoming a certified public accountant, and then went into, got out of public accounting eventually. I basically went down the entrepreneurial path and was mostly a CFO focused in technology. And then eventually, I got really tired of working for other people and just decided I wanted to work for myself. I had one consulting client when I left my last employer and just decided I was going to start my own business. Didn't even know what know what it was. You know, I was going to consult, do some CFO consulting work for this one client and figure the rest out. And I'm really glad I did that because it gave me it liberated me cognitively, gave me enough space and attention span. I wasn't so, you know, buried in the corporate rat race that I had time to pay attention to what was going on. And that was late 16 going into early 17. And I started to pay attention to crypto. And basically one thing led to another. And I ended up, you know, I'll fast forward again, basically the weekend the book The Bitcoin Standard is released in April 2018, I was already pretty deep into the crypto rabbit hole at this point, increasingly becoming more interested in Bitcoin and less interested in crypto, which is something we can talk about. Like there's a bright line between these two worlds. And then when The Bitcoin Standard came out, I read it the weekend it was released, and that was sort of the last piece of the puzzle for me, understanding that Bitcoin was actually the solution to central banking, which I had discovered in The Creature from Jekyll Island years before. And at that point, I became what many people would say maximalized as a Bitcoiner. And, you know, a few months later, I got my first tattoo, which is a Bitcoin emblem under my right arm, my first and only tattoo, which represents skin in the game to me. And I feel very philosophically and humanistically committed to this mission. It's, you know, if you look out on the world and you see a giant crime syndicate running the show and you see a possible solution, right? Yeah, I feel like you'd be crazy not to put everything you've got into it. So I'm trying to do my best to educate, learn, talk about it, be about it. And that's led me to the podcast. Basically, I started the What is Money show in November 2020. We've released almost 500 episodes now, exploring the nature and history of money. It's not a finance podcast. It's actually much more of a philosophy podcast. As you probably know, we talk about everything. And that's been very enjoyable. And a lot of people have gotten value out of it, so I'm very grateful for that, and I'm grateful that I get to nerd out for a living and hopefully make a difference in the process.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thanks for sharing that story. Yeah, it's definitely more of a philosophy podcast, and it is very valuable content, and I really appreciate it and enjoy it. It's funny you mentioned, you know, when you stopped working, I guess, like the corporate world, you finally created space in your life that allowed you to pay attention. And I mean, we're called the mindful movement, and my wife and I have been practicing different mindfulness-based strategies for a long time. And, you know, there's different, like, people will define that different ways, but to me, it's basically paying attention. So it's like when you apply mindfulness to this aspect that's integrated with really every part of our life, like the economics that are kind of intertwined or really built in all of our decisions. When you pay attention and you apply mindfulness to it, the value that Bitcoin seems to offer really shines, and it seems undeniable. So you referenced, and I don't know if people are going to be familiar with this, but you have cryptocurrency, which is almost like slanderous to Bitcoin in some way. It's a different thing. You mentioned, you know, there's a bright line that separates them. One of the things that you alluded to is how our currency gets destructed due to the system that it's that like modulates it, that regulates it, the central banks. And one of the reasons Bitcoin is like the answer to that is it's just like you said earlier, you were looking to exit, like it's the outside of the system mechanism. And it can't be, I guess, inflated because people can't come in and, due to greed or desire for power, just print more to do things with, whether it's fight wars, like you said, or, you know, whatever ideas they have. So one thing that you referenced in your podcast that winds up leading to is a change in the way you look at money relative to time. Like, I have a local gym. And one thing that I've noticed over the years working with folks in the gym environment is, like, the person that comes in and says, I'm getting married in like 2 weeks or 2 months, I got to lose 10 pounds to fit my dress. It's a really uninteresting client to work with. It's very superficial in a way. But when you're working with someone that is open to connecting with why they're there in the long term, like the fact that they maybe want to be able to play with their grandkids when they're older, or go out on their own terms, avoid the nursing home, it makes the day-to-day decisions not just clearer, but more matter-of-fact with less internal conflict that's getting in your way. Like when you see maybe, you know, a pizza or whatever, and it's like, maybe, oh, I want that. And then there's a voice in your head that's like, oh, no, you shouldn't. You have this like weird conflict. But a lot of that arises because the lack of clarity over what those long-term goals are. And with fiat currency or money, the U.S. dollar, the primary money that we use, because it's destructed over time, it's not harder, but we're less connected with that long-term value of it, which changes the way you look at how to spend your time or your money today. I don't know if I'm clarifying that well, but maybe you could speak to that idea, how it shifts because you know that it's protected on some level and it won't be devalued over time naturally due to just like the human components that influence the system.
Yeah, so we can maybe connect a couple of these things together. I recently read the book The Art of Power by, is it Thich Nhat Hanh? I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly. Vietnamese individual, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he said mindfulness is just like doing things with your full being and attention, right? So when you're pouring the tea, you're just pouring the tea. You're not, you know, thinking about what you have to do later. You're not, you know, concerned, you know, anxious about the future or regretful about the past. You're sort of just living in the moment. All of your faculties and awareness are focused on the moment. You know, I guess living in a place where your monkey mind is not controlling you. You're sort of in charge. Now, the opposite of mindfulness would be something like a state of anxiety, right? Where you are concerned about the future, or, you know, maybe you're, I guess the opposite of, if it's anxiety would be about the future, regret or depression would be about the past, perhaps, you know, the state where you're not fully engaged, you're actually withdrawn or distracted or not present in whatever activity you're doing. Now, anxiety can come from a lot of things, but I would say one definite way to give people anxiety is to just make them physically or financially insecure, right? If someone's got a gun pointed to your head, you're going to feel some anxiety, right? Because your physical being is being threatened. If you've got a negative balance in your bank account and you've got bills due, right? And you've got kids to feed, probably going to feel some insecurity and some anxiety related to that, right? There's people that are depending on you and you don't have the means to provide for them. So this relationship between financial security and long-term outlook versus short-term outlook is something economists call time preference. And there's a lot of things that influence your time preference. I don't know if you have kids. Kids tend to be something that really lower your time preference, which is to say make you think longer term. Because, well, guess what? They're young, and your actions today really influence their lives, you know, 5, 10, 20 years into the future. So whereas you might have been a little more hedonistic in your 20s, you know, drinking, partying, carrying on, you get married, you settle down, you have a couple of kids, all of a sudden you're probably not drinking so much, you're probably working a little harder, you're probably saving a little more, just all around being a more responsible, thoughtful individual with a longer term outlook on life. Another thing that can lower your time preference, which is to say extend your time horizon, is savings, right? The ability to preserve wealth into the future is what gives you the freedom to plan for that future, right? If all of your savings were in Zimbabwe dollars when they went into hyperinflation, and everything you had worked for to, you know, your nest egg that you had worked to stash away for 10 or 20 years was just getting vaporized, well, then your sphere of concern across time shrinks, right? You can't worry about 10 years from now. Your savings just got evaporated. You're worried about how to eat next week, or maybe even the next day or the next month, wherever, you know, it falls out. And so there's a direct relationship between how securely people can store wealth across time and how adequately they can plan for the future and have this longer term orientation. And there's also a connection to morality here, because the more you consider the consequences of your actions across time, it's like you're evaluating things in a larger bubble, and the larger that bubble becomes, the more you're considering it, your impact, the impact of your actions on other people as well, not just slices of your future self, but also future others. And so this idea of having a world running out of money that is counterfeited at will by, you know, basically there's 7 governors inside the Federal Reserve, when we don't know who the shareholders are, we don't know who owns this business, it's not federal and there are no reserves. That's one of the inside jokes in libertarianism, right? It's not a government agency. It's not. It's a private bank. We don't know who owns it. There are no reserves, right? The central bank does hold gold, but those reserves are not in any way pegged to the currency. The currency is just a fiat currency. It's a pyramid scheme. It's a confidence game. There's nothing backing it, no tangible value whatsoever. Just the threat of force, basically. It says, you know, you will pay taxes in these dollars or else. And that's how they create reservation demand and get people to hold it. But the reality is there's no substance there at all. When you have a world running on that currency system, and obviously the dollars, since there's no backing, There's no check, right? The people can't call the government's bluff and say, you know what, I think you've printed too much money. I want to redeem this money for gold now, something that can't be printed. That vote of no confidence does not exist. So the government can just print money and inflate the money supply as much as it wants to steal the purchasing power of savers. And when it can do that, people's savings just gets crushed in terms of purchasing power. And so what you're doing is you're shrinking the time horizons of people and arguably shrinking their moral outlook as well. And so I'll stop there and see if you have any questions, but that's the relationship. And if you wanted to dig more into it, I would encourage people, you could actually read the book. The Bitcoin Standard has a great section on time preference, and it just describes how lowering our time preference is actually the process of civilization. Like the more we consider the consequences of our actions across time, you know, the less caveman we are and the more civilized we become, basically. So if we reverse that process, we're actually reversing the process of civilization itself, and money printing is a component of that reversal.
Gotcha. Yeah, so there's a lot I could touch on there. I don't know how much I want to go into just the depth of like how depressing that system is. I guess focusing on more of the potential bright side ahead and the solutions. I mean, Bitcoin came into existence as a solution to many things, and that being one of them, that being, I guess, primary, that somebody who we don't know who they are created this, in a sense, we assume, to kind of give society its best chance going forward to come out of this system that really has this deleterious effect on society as a whole, in hopes that it encourages really the opposite phenomenon to manifest going forward, creating a more sound society that could rest their attention really on, like, literally to be more present, like you alluded to, because you don't have the anxiety of your stash just deteriorating with time and getting out of whatever cycles of thoughts, actions, behaviors that system drives, and which would create, you know, ultimately a community, a society based more on like the positive vibes, like, you know, love, compassion, empathy, you know, the good stuff.
Yeah, it's really bad, because not only does this, and this is a very key point, and a lot of people resonate with this sort of shortening of the whole thing. Inflation is legal counterfeiting. Counterfeiting is criminal inflation. So there's no economic distinction whatsoever between you going to try and print a $20 bill and pass it off as the real thing, right? You would go to jail for that. That's counterfeiting. That is the same activity the Federal Reserve engages in by the trillion, right? There's literally no distinction whatsoever. Just it's legal for one group and not legal for another group. So it's this bifurcation of the law, right? The central bank actually exists above the law. This is why, as one of the Rothschilds family famously said, they said, give me the power to issue a nation's currency. I care not who makes its laws. Money is superordinate to law, right? You can buy law and buy legislators when you can print money. So this theft not only steals from people that are prudent, right? People that are saving, people that are earning more than they spend and saving, they're being robbed through this inflation. But it's also skewing the incentives. So you're penalizing prudence, but you're simultaneously rewarding politicking, basically, for lack of a better term, right? So your incentive becomes, rather than being a prudent, productive entrepreneur and like going into the marketplace to solve problems for paying customers, I can actually get richer just getting very close, politically close to the money printer, right? If I can be a politician or, you know, a shareholder of a central bank, something like that, if I can just get close, politically aligned to the money printer, then I can get rich through producing nothing. And so you start to incentivize immorality, right? You incentivize people to be dishonest and cunning and politicking rather than competent, prudent, productive. And so there's this disruption, this rupture, if you will, in the fabric of society itself. And Hoppe writes about this in his book, A Theory of Socialism and Capitalism. Because what's happening here, in essence, is a violation of private property, right? Savers have accumulated, they've earned more than they've spent, and they've accumulated reserves of money as savings. A key point here, by the way, is those savings, we often think of savings as money in the bank, but what the savings actually represents is goods that have been produced but not yet consumed. Those individuals that have gone into the marketplace and produced something, they've sold something, and they've taken money in exchange, if they haven't yet spent that money, then they've added to the productive output of humanity, but they have not consumed from it. So they've actually added to the stock of goods in the world, right? They've improved the world. So when people have savings, that's what it should be a reflection of. It's a reflection of how many favors you've rendered to the market and are you in turn due from the market. That's how it's supposed to work. Now, if those savings can be diluted through inflation and someone can be made rich just from printing money, they've not rendered any productive favors to the market at all, right? They've actually done the opposite. They've done a disservice by stealing from the guy that did render favors to the marketplace. Well, what does that make people want to do, right? The ease with which property can be violated is like equivalent to the moral decomposition of society, because people will, if that's the path of least resistance to attain wealth, then people will go that direction. But if private property is made very unbreakable and very strong, then people won't pursue that as a wealth acquisition strategy. People will pursue prudent, long-term trading, entrepreneurial relationships. Exactly. So what we're trying to get to, like, and this is, it's so utterly simple because a three-year-old understands it, right? A three-year-old understands the importance of private property. Go take a three-year-old's toy and see how they react, right? Just take it from them. See how they react. Like, it's mine, my toy, give it back. You know, this isn't right. That's the principle we're trying to implement in human civilization. It's like, just don't steal from anyone. Do not steal. This is the core dictum of natural law. And do not steal includes do not kill, because you own yourself. You own your own body. To kill someone is to steal their life, essentially. And to incarcerate someone against their will is to steal their freedom, right? And to steal their property is to take the fruits of their past freedom. So it's very simple, yet very difficult to, I guess, overcome this animalistic urge people have to take the path of least resistance. So the key engineering element we have to consider is, how do we make private property as inviolable as possible? Because the extent to which we can make it inviolable is the same extent to which we can incentivize people to act good and proper, to be civilized, to be productive, to be peaceful. And to that end, Bitcoin is one of the greatest advancements in human history, because it is the most difficult private property right to violate known to man. It cannot be inflated, as you said, and if you custody it properly, it's damn near impossible to seize.
Yeah, I want to get into that custody in just a moment, but just to finish up on the inflation, I mean, now, one of the weird silver linings in some way over those last several years is that more people understand that inflation is bad. Mm-hmm. I mean,
paying this information.
There was a long time where, you know, I remember seeing books in the library, just multiple books about inflation, all implying that a little bit of inflation is good. And it's almost like they have this target, I think, you know, generally 2%, give or take, where it's like they choose to devalue the currency at a rate slow enough. They, I guess they just, it's like, how much can we get away with without destroying society or, yeah, like letting you know? So, you know, you give up maybe, you know, half your wealth over the course of your lifetime because it's slow. You don't notice. But I mean, during early in like COVID, when I saw prices going crazy, I have weird insecurities around certain things, and like food is one of them. I'm like a total foodie and got extra freezer in the basement, and I like had a freezer full of food, like way more than 95% of the people I'm sure have in their house. And I freaked out, bought another freezer and filled it up. And because of, it's like, I didn't know where the price was going. I saw supply going down. I saw prices going up. I saw, we went and got a chicken coop and got chickens and just to have a little bit more control of the food supply. But like very quickly, my behaviors changed from those initial, you know, those just initial effects of how the market was unfolding with like the government trying to fix the situation by printing more. And, you know, everybody has their own like versions of, I guess, how they're affected by that. And I also remember some really like disingenuous behavior from, I guess, like the state, government, media, or whatever, where they would kind of manipulate the definition of inflation so that, which was like, and I could see how most people would buy that if you don't have a foundational understanding. I mean, if you went to, you don't learn this stuff in like high school, and if you went to college and you studied art or engineering or medicine, like you're not getting enough to understand that they're lying to you when they say it's for a reason other than just flooding the money supply. So Bitcoin, one of the strengths you just alluded to is that you can't penetrate it essentially. And I don't really, I believe in all the philosophies around Bitcoin. I feel like an absolute idiot around the tech. I don't know what a blockchain is, a node, a hash rate, any of that stuff. I don't know if it's important, but I do know that custody is important. And for practical purposes, and for like selfish reasons, really, I wanted to get your opinion of how to approach that, because I see a lot of different opinions and I see all kinds of companies marketing that there is the best way to store this. And I know there's different tools now, because now if you have like a retirement account or you have some kind of access to like a stock market, you could essentially purchase a Bitcoin ETF and have a position that way. And it's maybe not a perfect way to get exposure, but it's probably better than most, you know, for a lot of people, it's a reasonable way to approach it. But can you talk about what custody really means in the realm of Bitcoin? Like, what does it mean to hold a keys or a wallet or?
Sure. So Bitcoin is a different animal. It is the first digitally native asset. It is the only fixed supply asset. And I mean, I've argued about this in a piece I wrote titled The Number Zero in Bitcoin. I think it's the only fixed supply asset we will ever have. I really view this as a one-time invention. Obviously, the analogy I draw that piece is to the invention of the number zero. And it's a long piece, so I won't go into the whole argument here, but people that think Bitcoin could be disrupted by, say, Bitcoin 2.0, they really need to study much more closely. It's equivalent to thinking that the number zero would be replaced by the number zero 2.0. You know, like it doesn't make sense, but I won't go into the details on that. But people could read that piece if they were interested. It's called The Number Zero in Bitcoin. If you just Google that and my name, it should come up. We published it on Medium and on Substack. And so because Bitcoin is a digitally native asset, it is essentially pure information. You have a piece of a digital spreadsheet, if you will, but the digital spreadsheet is an absolute fixed supply, and it's protected by real energy. So it's like, it is, as Michael Saylor likes to say, it's protected by a wall of encrypted energy. But so to hold, to be able to move funds, which is to say reassign ownership of a piece of this spreadsheet to someone else, all you need is a private key, basically. And the private key, which you could think of by way of analogy as your Bitcoin password, although the analogy is not perfect because you can't reset your password, right? Bitcoin's not a company. If you lose your private key, you can't call Bitcoin HQ and have them reset your password as you would do with Google or whatever else. Bitcoin's not a company. Bitcoin is an internet protocol, basically. There is no one to call. There is no HQ. There is no corporation. There is no organization. It's like HTTP or SMTP or TCP/IP, right? These are just internet protocols that were adopted on the free market. To own the Bitcoin is to own that piece of information called the private key. If you lose that piece of information, you've lost the Bitcoin, right? It's the physical custody of that information, or the keeping of that secret, if you will, that is possession, that is physical possession of the Bitcoin. It's like if you hold gold coins in your hand, right? If you throw them overboard at sea and they sink to the bottom of the ocean, there's no one to call and get them back, right? There's no gold HQ. There's no gold, you know, customer service that you can call and say, hey, can you fish my coins off the bottom of the sea? That's the equivalent of what happens if you lose your Bitcoin private key. So it's very serious, you know, and people would say, why would you want that, right? That sounds like a terrible idea. I prefer JP Morgan Chase, where if I, you know, lose my bank account password, I call them up and they reset it. It's like, okay, great. Maybe you want that convenience with some of your financial accounts. However, that convenience comes at great cost. If you were a protester during the Canadian trucker protest, you learned very quickly what cost that comes with, right? That your money can be turned off at the touch of a button. If you say something the government doesn't like, or you know, do anything that the government doesn't like, it can be deactivated at the press of a button. And so Bitcoin gives its users great power in that you own what's called a bearer asset. Like, again, just like holding gold coins in your hand, if whoever is the physical possessor of gold coins is presumed to be their rightful owner. The same is true with Bitcoin. Whoever possesses the private key is the owner of that Bitcoin. But if you don't custody that properly and you lose it, then you lose it with finality. There is no reversing the process. There is no reversing Bitcoin transactions. Just like if I hand you a bar of gold and you walk away, there's no reversing that transaction, right? I would have to go to you and get you to give it back to me. Same is true with Bitcoin. Only Bitcoin's done digitally. So the key with Bitcoin is self-custody, right? You're not going to realize the full value of Bitcoin if you trust anyone else. And this means anyone, any institution, any country, any bank, any organization, any custodian whatsoever to hold your keys on your behalf. Because then you are not holding Bitcoin, you're holding a promise to Bitcoin from someone, and it's a promise that can be broken and often is broken. And this includes Bitcoin ETFs. People may feel more comfortable and say, oh, it's a regulated financial entity, and you know, they have all these, the SEC, the oversight, etc. But like, the first, if I am a government and I want to seize a lot of Bitcoin with very little effort, the first thing I would do would be to seize Coinbase custody, which is the custodian for like 10 out of 11 of these ETFs. That is the most juice for the least squeeze, right? So if you're holding your Bitcoin in a Bitcoin ETF, okay, maybe it's very convenient for you. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to figure it out. But just know, if shit ever hits the fan, you're not going to ever see that Bitcoin again. At best, they will send you a CBDC and say, hey, we seized all the Bitcoin, but don't worry, we're paying you in the CBDC, which is a central bank digital currency, that we can print ad infinitum. So there's very serious counterparty risk that come into play when you do anything other than hold your own keys, which is why we say in Bitcoin, not your keys, not your cheese.
Gotcha. A couple things there. First of all, I've never really thought of the ETFs like that. The fact that if they did want to seize, that would be the easiest way to get a lot quickly where companies would have to.
It's one phone call. One phone call. There's already 500,000 Bitcoin, I think, in those ETFs. One phone call from a government agency, and it's all seized.
500,000 Bitcoin. Wow. And for the listeners, if you don't know, there's 21 million total, and there will never be more. So that's a big chunk of it. This is going to sound probably like a stupid question before we get into more details about the custody. But I'm so not hip with technology. Where does it live? Like, you say it's a protocol, I think was the word you used.
Yeah, the answer to the question would be the same answer to the question, where does the internet live? Bitcoin is the internet. What is the internet? The internet is a stack of open source protocols for moving information without asking permission. So we have, HTTP, you see at the beginning of when you type a web address and you've got HTTP in the beginning, right?
Yeah, I've never understood what that's for.
Yeah, so essentially it's a hyper transfer text protocol, I believe is what it stands for. And there's just these different layers that have enabled the internet to come into existence. Another one is SMTP, the Simple Mail Transfer Protocol, which is for email, TCP/IP, and there's others. And it's just a stack of these protocols. People interacting on the internet, free market participants, have just chosen whatever the best... think of a protocol as kind of like a language. Right, you're choosing which language to speak, but then eventually network effects take hold, and everyone to communicate together. There's economic efficiency to be gained if everyone speaks the same language, right? If you could imagine running a company and everyone speaks English, that's a lot better than if your 50 employees speak 30 different languages. That's going to create a lot more friction, let's say. So the internet has ossified into this stack of protocols that allow us to do things like create websites without asking permission, communicate without asking permission. All of these wonderful things the internet has enabled is really facilitated through these open source protocols. Bitcoin is just another one of those. It's just the latest layer in the internet protocol suite. That's what they actually call that stack of protocols, is the Internet Protocol Suite. You could Google this and see a visual diagram of it. I think there's 7 layers.
But it can't be attacked from that angle of being a internet protocol. Is it because there's too many computers or servers or whatever, sharing the information that you would never be a, that if some get attacked, the information is still stored on the other ones? Or
so there's to finish the thought on Bitcoin as an internet protocol, it's the same thing as what the internet does, except instead of moving information without permission, we can now move purchasing power or economic value without permission. And it can be attacked, right? You can attack anything, an internet protocol is whatever you want. However, these things live everywhere and nowhere, right? Specifically, Bitcoin is being mined all over the world. You asked about what hash rate is earlier. Hash rate is the amount of energy being allocated into securing the Bitcoin network by Bitcoin miners. The amount of energy, it's already vastly, by an order of magnitude, the most secure computing network on Earth, right? There's nothing that even holds a candle to it. So to attack that network, you would need 51% of the energy to attack it. That's the one vulnerability Bitcoin has. It's called a 51% attack. But the game theory is such that you would need to marshal 51% of the energy on the network. Well, no country on Earth has anywhere near that amount of resources. And so you can attack it, but there's also an, even if you got 51% of the energy, there's also the fact that it's more economically advantageous to just use that hash rate that you command to mine Bitcoin, right? Because if you attack the network and you don't succeed in destroying it totally, then you've spent an incredible amount of money attacking it and you've earned nothing. Whereas if you spend that money and mine Bitcoin, then you're at least spending that energy to accumulate something of value, basically. And so that's the energetic, the wall of encrypted energy that protects it. And then the individual nodes that are choosing which language to speak, right? Which protocol to run, which is Bitcoin Core, they are, they basically hold the entire history of Bitcoin on each node. So each node is a self-contained version of all of Bitcoin's transaction history. And they're all checking each other. They're reachable nodes, there's over 20,000. Yeah, and it changes because sometimes people take their nodes online and offline depending on how people are using it. And so it's this sort of feedback loop between mining and nodes that makes Bitcoin very decentralized and very difficult to attack. And in theory, you could destroy every node on Earth except one, and Bitcoin would persist. So it's like this. It's the analogy I like to use here is the Bible, right? You can go on a Bible burning campaign until you're blue in the face. You can burn a bunch of Bibles. But you're never going to get rid of the Bible, like as an idea. It is so decentralized, so widely copied, you know, so many copies of it everywhere, so many different mediums that it's copied in, electronic, physical, people memorize it, etc. You're never going to fully get rid of that idea, right? And Bitcoin is sort of similar, right? It's just copied everywhere, and a lot, you know, people are doing cold backups, there's hot backups, active nodes, cold nodes, and it's being recorded all the time and updated across all these different decentralized points, that to try and destroy it everywhere, you would have to destroy it everywhere at every single point. You'd have to destroy every single record, like you'd have to burn every single Bible and eradicate it from every single person's mind. And it just becomes an unfeasible notion.
That's an interesting analogy. So every node has all the histories in it.
Correct.
That's cool. Okay, so custody. So you need to have your own keys, otherwise it's not really yours.
Yeah.
I see words like, I have a cold wallet. I bought a cold wallet, which it looks like a USB drive type thing. And after a lot of attempts, figured out how to get some Bitcoin on it. And I don't know what to do with the thing. There was 12 words I'm supposed to keep safe. I don't know how to approach that. I see words like multi-sig, not really sure what that means. I have a family. I'm like, for me, I think about it as a way to preserve, you know, the value that me and my wife create, and pass, so that we could pass down and not have it destroyed, essentially. And I don't know the best way to do that. Like, when I have this little thing, I see it and I'm like, well, I could lose that. And then it's like throwing the gold over the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, well, you just have to have your 12 words. And if there's no Bitcoin headquarters, what do I do with the 12 words? Where do I go with that? Can you touch on the logistics of how all that works? How the average person should approach custody?
Yeah, so the 12 words basically are your private key, or they're not the actual private key, but they are what's called a mnemonic phrase that allows you to access the private key. Basically, for all intents and purposes, having those 12 or 24 words, depending on the wallet you're using, is the possession of your private key. So if those words were to get out, right, and someone else obtained them, then they could move your Bitcoin and that would be game over. So that is the issue with self-custody in a single wallet setup where you just have one wallet, one private key, or one device and one PIN number, right? You have one hardware wallet, basically. Although that does give you full control over your assets and you're not trusting a custodian, you do have single point of failure, right? You lose, all you need to do is lose the physical device and the PIN and the 12 words, or the 12 words need to get compromised. Someone gets them out of your safe or whatever the thing is, and your Bitcoin's gone. So a more effective custody model is what you just brought up, which is multi-sig, or also called multi-key custody, also called collaborative custody. So you can take your one private key and basically chop it into 3, 5, 7 pieces, which they call shards. You can then distribute those pieces or shards to people in your circle of trust, right? Could be your wife, your accountant, your attorney, your kids, your friend, whoever, right? You choose. And then you need a simple majority, essentially, to what's called a quorum, to move those funds. So you need 3 of 5 or 5 of 7, right, of those keys to then move the funds. What this affords you is redundancy, right? You can lose one of those devices. In the case of a 2 of 3, you can lose one and you're still okay, right? You still got 2 of 3. In the case of a 3 of 5, you can lose 2 and you're still okay. You've still got 3 of 5. So you get redundancy, you hedge against that single point of failure risk, but you also retain full control over your assets. And so this multi-sig, I think, is like the best of both worlds. It's slightly more complicated to set up. However, there's companies that do it. Like I strongly recommend anyone that's holding a substantial amount of money in Bitcoin, whatever substantial means to you, right? It's all relative. Maybe 10 bucks is substantial to you. I don't know. Once you are holding an amount of money that you don't want to lose, use a multi-sig, right? And it's, you know, the company, you can do it yourself. I would only suggest that if you're very technically sophisticated. That's something I would want to do. I'm not super technically sophisticated. But companies like Casa, Unchained, there's several others out there. Those are both US-based companies. They offer this multi-sig custody setup and like a white glove service. So they'll just walk you through the whole process.
Okay. Is there risk there for that company? Like if that company goes out of business?
No, because you're still, they're just facilitating the setup. Basically you're holding the keys.
Oh, they don't hold one of the keys.
You can optionally let them hold one of the keys, right? If you had 2 of 3, you wanted to hold 2, they hold 1. That's an option. But you don't have to, no.
And okay, this is very interesting. So it's basically because of that redundancy, you're protected if you screw up one of the keys, as long as you have enough people that is the majority. So if you set up 3 keys, you lose 1, you take the other 2, but then you might, is there any risk there, whereas the other 2 have some type of control now and power over, like what if there's I'm thinking like all the families that like have fallouts and...
This is where the game theory comes into play, and you have to design it in a way that mitigates those risks, right? So typically, you would want to have the other people in your circle of trust ideally not be in your immediate locale, right? You don't want to all be living in the same house, for instance. You'd want someone in a different location.
You mean if the house burns down or something?
The house burns down, or if someone were to break in and you're all there, right? It's like, okay, you did a 3 of 5 multi-key setup, but all 5 of you are sitting right there with the keys. Like that defeats the purpose, right? You might as well just kept it on one hard drive or one hard wallet. So you want individuals holding shards in different locations. In often cases, you don't want them to know about each other, right? So you'll tell someone, hey, you hold a shard and this is the deal. You know, you're 1 of 5 and I'm not telling you who the other 4 are. Something like that. So that way they can't collude, right? If everyone knew who they were, then you could have the family fallout situation you just described where, you know, if you trusted 3 of your family members and a 3 of 5, they could collude against you and take the Bitcoin or whatever it may be. So you have to design, there is a there's some complexity related to the design there, but these are things that, again, these companies will help walk you through, is just like how to think about it. And typically, like, you know, a two of three is typically enough for most people. And, you know, a lot of people just use their accountant, their attorney, their spouse. And, you know, that tends to be enough.
That's interesting. I appreciate the clarity on that. That makes a lot of sense. That is an interesting way. Now, I could see how for a lot of people, even that, though, like, especially when I think of my parents or older generations, like, I could see how that would be so overwhelming to even, well, I mean, you've been at this for a while, and I assume you talk to a lot of people and, you know, different walks of life. I mean, do you generally find that the people that gravitate towards Bitcoin more in generally are just younger, more technologically savvy people?
Without a doubt. I mean, if you've grown up with digital technology as a feature of your life, you're much more likely to trust the preservation of your purchasing power to digital technology. Whereas if you're, you know, in your 70s, this stuff is like hocus pocus.
Right. Even if you agree with a lot of the principles, like, you could be 70 and literally have a treasure map to show your family where you buried gold.
Yeah.
Well, like, so you could have the mindset of why it matters, but the technology might be too much.
Gold bugs are basically old school Bitcoiners. You've probably heard of gold bugs, right? Guys that have been talking out against the Fed for, you know, forever. Them and saying, you know, you got to buy gold. This whole thing's going to collapse. It's all a scam. Same principles, same outlook, world outlook. Different solution, right? Gold bugs choose gold because, well, that's all that was available pre-Bitcoin, and Bitcoiners choose Bitcoin. I'm an old millennial, so I'm almost 39. I'm like, I think millennials stop at 40. And so I grew up before smartphones. I remember a time pre-smartphone, you know, I came up on the internet basically. So I'm like kind of a cusp. I don't know if I'm a digital native, but not quite, right? I didn't grow up with these devices, but in my late teens, early 20s, these devices started to become mainstream. So for me, digital technology is very comfortable, right? I think it's a main feature of the world today and will continue to be a main feature into the future of the world into the future. Gold bugs might not feel that way. So they have a different solution, even though they have the same diagnosis.
I feel like this topic deserves so much more than we could do in this time. But I do feel like we touched on a bunch of different angles of the topic. If somebody wanted to, if somebody's relatively new and they hear about it, and they probably just hear bad things about what people on TV are saying about or something, and they want to learn more, where is the place that you generally recommend to start, other than your podcast?
Goodness. Well, I don't know if starting, I mean, I'll just throw out a few options here. One, I mentioned the Bitcoin Standard. If you like to read books, I think that's an excellent place to start. It actually spends the first two-thirds of the book going through the history of money, the nature of money before it even goes into Bitcoin. So although it's called the Bitcoin Standard, it's much more of a deep dive on money itself. So it'll give you a good grasp on that. You could check out episode one of my podcast. The first 9 episodes I did are with Michael Saylor.
Well, Robert, thanks again for taking the time, and really grateful for what you're doing with your podcast. Like I said, I do really enjoy it. I've been listening for quite some time now, and it's, I find it, not just inspiring, but it's clear, it's calm. It keeps me grounded when I'm thinking, because I will get a little, I guess, anxious around some of the topics, and I could get angry at, you know, the big criminality of, like, what has happened with our society in regards to money. And I feel like you stay fairly positive and grounded, and it's for me personally, it's good for me. It's good for me to have that drip in my ear. So I appreciate it. And I hope our paths cross again in the future. For the listeners out there, always grateful for your listening. I hope you got value out of this, and I definitely encourage you to check out the What Is Money podcast, and you know, have an open mind and see where that takes you, and maybe you might just be orange pilled too one day. Thanks again, Robert.